Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm looking at American air doctrine during the 1930s and the development of four-engine bombers, particularly the B-17A Flying Fortress. And the reason why I want to look at this is because during the 1930s there was a growing awareness that the next war would be fought from the air, and that already Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy and Imperial Japan were all experimenting with aircraft and trying to explore how aircraft could be used to change events on the ground, to change realities on the ground, and how they could be used to support ground troops, and particularly how they could be used as weapons of terror. Interestingly, Britain and America come to the aviation game in the 1930s slightly later, and yet ultimately the outcome of the Anglo-American developments in air power are arguably far more significant because of the development of British and American four-engine bombers. And the thinking and the arguments and the politics behind it, I think, are the interesting bit. Today I'm looking at Richard Overy's The Bombing War, which is probably the best single volume I've ever read on the politics, economics and military history of aviation during the Second World War. So the start point for this was the fact that some American aviators had actually witnessed large-scale bombing before. And they had witnessed London in 1917 and 1918 being bombed by German four-engine Gotha bombers during a number of major air attacks described by some as the first Blitz. There had been, obviously, American servicemen in Great Britain during the war and during the last 2 years of the war anyway. And they had seen how actually successful the German air raids had been and how close to actually devastating London they had been. In the early 1920s, and the head of the then air service, Major General Mason Patrick, advocated that, and I quote, "decisive blows from the air on rear areas might end future conflicts." So this was the first major kind of advocacy of civilian bombing, of bombing military and economic infrastructure in order to break the ability of the army to replenish itself, to supply itself on the battlefield. And this becomes, during the Second World War, the key part of American strategy, American bombing strategy over Europe. As with Great Britain, in America, there was a degree of inter-service rivalry. The idea that wars could be won by air forces a long way from the battlefield bombing the interior of an enemy country made heads of the army, heads of the US army, feel alarmed that they were perhaps eventually going to be sidelined for resources or made redundant altogether. The other great advocate was General Billy Mitchell, who obviously was a huge and significant figure in the air war over Europe during the Second World War. Mitchell was a huge and outspoken advocate of air power as the new way of war, the future of warfare. And he argued that attacks on transportation and industrial centres using high explosive incendiary and even gas bombs could mean the difference between victory and defeat. And he came up with this notion of vital centres. What he was really talking about there was infrastructure as opposed to mass civilian killing, though unfortunately during the war the two are synonymous with one another. And again, there was this sense of inter-service anxiety that the Air Force, the Army and the Navy might possibly be made redundant by the Air Force. Mitchell was actually court-martialed in 1925 for making outspoken demands for an Air Force that was independent of the Army. The Air Force only really becomes independent of the Army during the war itself. In 1935, the General Headquarters Air Force appointed as its commander Major General Frank Andrews. And he also supported the idea of bombing vital centres, nodes of economic infrastructure and activity, with oil refineries, power plants, utilities, and centres of population. And this would be the most effective way to use bomber squadrons. And even though this was by no means Air Force kind of orthodoxy, during the 1930s, it begins to be taught at various Air Corps tactical schools, and young officers who would form the nucleus of the Air Force during the war became convinced of it as an orthodoxy. And these were men who, by 1941, had risen to senior leadership roles. One lecture in 1935 to Air Force officers read, "Civilization has rendered the economic and social life of a nation increasingly vulnerable to attack. Sound strategy requires that the main blow be struck where the enemy is weakest." And the will of the enemy population, it was theorised, could be broken by assaulting the social body. The social body was a terminology for that web of modern urban life, of transport, supplies, amenities, facilities, the infrastructure that was part of kind of civilian life during wartime, but during peacetime, but could also be co-opted by the military during war. In order to demonstrate this, it was a kind of a speculative wargaming operation happened in April 1939 on the city of New York and its surrounding area. And it was theorised that only two squadrons of bombers could destroy the electricity power generating system for the entire city and paralyse it within a matter of hours. The Air Corps tended to operate in something of a vacuum during the 1930s, as there was no official air doctrine, no big plan that would result in it being equipped in a particular way and deployed in a particular way. And there was also no idea of there being a strategic, no model of a strategic offensive. that aircraft, in short, the US Army wasn't quite sure exactly what to do with aircraft to maximise their efficacy. In 1933, the Air Corps was allowed to explore the development of the four-engine bomber and ensure that this was really to make sure that more than anything else that military aviation technology continued apace with civilian aviation, and also continued apace with the rest of the world. Theorists of the arms industry will often argue that one of the reasons for allowing such a huge amount of public money to pour into the arms industry is to allow constant innovation in research and development. If there are arms contracts, people will build new and more advanced kinds of arms, and therefore one's arms industry will not be idling just at the wrong moment. So the development of this four-engine bomber was won by the Boeing Company, which in 1935 produced a prototype called the XB-17, and this was the forerunner to the B-17A Flying Fortress. It had a range of 1,800 miles and carried 4,000 pounds of bombs. The Army had approved it only, ironically, as a defensive aircraft. However, it seemed to have almost no defensive role whatsoever. So it was a kind of an anomaly, something of a white elephant. It was designed to protect the long routes to Panama, Alaska and Hawaii. So this was perhaps thought out as an anti-shipping aircraft designed to protect American naval convoys. But things begin to change. In 1936, the production order was cancelled altogether. However, 1936 is a very interesting year in terms of aviation. Or 35-36, not only had the use of aviation against civilians been witnessed in Abyssinia, but far more significantly in 36, it was witnessed in Spain. The relay flights of the German Air Force from Morocco to Spain, shipping Franco's Army of Africa over to Spain in order to do its bloody work across the country. And also the use of frontline support operations, the use of strategic battlefield bombing using medium bombers, Heinkels and Stuka dive bombers, had immensely stunned foreign onlookers. They saw them as being efficient, easy to operate, and most of all, cheap. The development of the B-17, therefore, begins to pick up a pace. All of a sudden, it is uncancelled and becomes part of a new project that Roosevelt will take a great deal of interest.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
But I just want to pause here for a moment and consider the directions that the Axis, the future Axis powers and the future Allies were both going in. German aircraft were battlefield support weapons. They were about the theory of Blitzkrieg, of deep operations, as the Soviets originally came up with the idea. Smaller, lighter bombers would punch a hull along with armoured columns through the front lines of an opposing army, or create attacks along the flank in order to see encirclement happen. But they were not really designed for mass city bombing. The bombers that attacked Britain in 1940 during the Blitz, compared to British four-engine bombers, are relatively small. Compared to American four-engine bombers, are relatively small. They are far more suited to rapid-moving wars of movement on the battlefield than to the steady, slow, attritional warfare of mass city bombing. And gradually, as air doctrines in Britain and America emerged, fundamentally different from those of the Germans and other Axis powers, the ways in which both sides fought the Second World War would change and develop and become fundamentally different. And if one looks at the scale of devastation from mass city bombing by the end of the Second World War, the conclusion might be that four-engine bombing of civilian areas in over-occupied Europe was of a far greater magnitude than that which the Axis powers were able to achieve. In late 1938, Franklin Roosevelt ordered a large-scale expansion in American military spending, and this included a massive commitment to the expansion of the Air Force. This was either to create an Air Force so huge, Roosevelt was thinking of 20,000 aircraft in the event about 15 times as many aircraft are produced in America during the war. But he was thinking of creating a vast air force, a vast air army, that could be either flown by American pilots in order to protect America, or could be simply gifted to Britain and France, and would be such an overwhelming threat to Hitler that it would eventually lead to Hitler abandoning his plans for European domination. The Air Board in March 1939 supported the idea of a heavy bomber, and the B-17 that was on the drawing board at the time from one single development model became overnight the heart of the American air strategy. The plans were developed to build 498 by 1941. 1,520 by the end of 1942. The first commitment of any air force to the employment of a heavy four-engine bomber. In the event, by late 1942, vastly more aircraft were built than that. The Consolidated Air Company was given the job of building the B-17. And instead, it actually designed its own bomber, the B-24 or the Liberator, which was eventually sent to equip Britain in 1941. Britain obviously had more than its fair share of its own models of four-engine bombers, but the Liberator had an enormous payload of 8,000 pounds, twice the amount of bombs that could be carried by either the B-17A or Britain's own Lancaster. David Reynolds, in his book The Long Shadow, which is an excellent kind of political, social, cultural history of the consequences of the First World War, he writes about Roosevelt here. American fear of war was intense yet abstract. 3,000 miles from Europe, there was no equivalent to the British panic about bombing. But Franklin Roosevelt was ahead of his countrymen in thinking about the implications of air warfare. During October 1938, he mulled over the lessons of the Czech crisis, absorbing reports from his ambassadors in Europe. This helped the president understand the gut-wrenching fear of mass airborne destruction that had gripped Paris and London during the crisis, helping them redress the air balance in the long-term interests of American security. Became his preoccupation during the winter of 1938-39. He told his military advisers that the recrudescence of German power at Munich had completely reoriented our own international relations, and that America must therefore immediately create a huge air force so that we do not need to have a huge army to follow that air force. He considered that sending an army abroad was undesirable and politically out of the question. So Roosevelt saw rearmament, particularly aircraft rearmament, as a form of diplomatic leverage. "When I write to foreign countries, I must have something to back up my words," he wrote. "Had we this summer 5,000 planes with the capacity immediately to produce 10,000 per year, even though I might had to ask Congress for the authority to sell or lend them to countries in Europe, Hitler would not have dared to take the stand he did." So Roosevelt's ideas about air rearmament were similar to those of the British. The British also thought that air force would be an alternative to sending a large army to Europe again. And sending a large army to Europe was politically unacceptable in the aftermath of the First World War and the horrors and sacrifices of the war. Obviously, Roosevelt believed that Hitler was unhinged and unbalanced. He referred to him as a nut. And that Germany, Italy and Japan were developing a wider policy of world domination, a network between them, which would later be the Axis power. That as a result of this, America must become the first line of defence for democratic values around the world, and that the continued existence of Britain and France was of vital strategic security to America. So the way in which the problem could be solved was through air technology, was through mass production. Keeping Britain and France afloat would ensure America's security, but if you could do that without sending a mass army to Europe, that would be great. And aircraft, particularly four-engine bombers, would be ideal. But even by 1939, even when the production of B-17s goes into full swing, there is still no officially agreed-upon doctrine about what to do with them. Roosevelt was particularly anxious about the possibility of a victorious Hitler establishing air bases in a Nazi-sympathetic South America, Argentina, Brazil, Colombia and Venezuela and other countries would have a very short fly time towards the southern United States, and that America had been really compromised by the existence of aviation, and that keeping peace and keeping America safe in an aviation age meant keeping Europe safe in that time. And in this, we can see one of the key motivations for Roosevelt being keen to establish the Lend-Lease agreement with Great Britain, and particularly the possibility of preventing the establishment of German air bases in the American hemisphere. Just as the British had realised that air power had kind of negated the English Channel, the American government had really begun to realise that air power was about to negate the splendid isolation they had been afforded by the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans. air policy for both the British and the Americans, as we'll eventually discover, was fundamentally changed by the crisis of 1940. The fact that the German army raced across Western Europe in a matter of weeks, that the British Expeditionary Force were forced back from Dunkirk across the Channel, and the fact that France had fallen and was no longer a major combative power for most of the war, meant that the entire fighting of the war, the entire war strategy, needed to be fundamentally rethought. Initially, it was generally believed that a large French army and a small British one would fight in Europe with a large British navy fighting on the seas, all of it being resupplied by a large American arsenal. And the fall of France fundamentally changes all of that, and it fundamentally has to rethink, has to change how air operations are fought and why they're fought. And it's from this, from having to rethink the war from scratch and figure out what to do, that strategic bombing emerges, and the need to gradually erode the capacity of the enemy in order to prepare eventually for a cross-channel invasion. So when, in the absence of an official air doctrine before the war begins, one emerges gradually piecemeal as a result of the crises of the war, until eventually an air doctrine emerges, particularly an American air doctrine that seems to have an overall strategic purpose. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.